from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Charlottesville, Virginia, in the summer of 2013. Charlottesville is a city southwest of Washington, D.C., and city leaders wanted an ambitious new look, a new plan. They turned to the Cunningham Quill firm based in D.C. to create that plan. And in Charlottesville, they were asking the same kinds of questions that we're often asking, whether it's in Ithaca, Geneva, or Rochester especially. How to address housing, how to address pedestrian and bike transportation, how to bring about neighborhood improvements, new investments, development and redevelopment, how to inject more green space, more of a walkable feel, how to be fair to everyone, constructing a plan that acknowledges mixed income, mixed needs for housing. Well, Cunningham Quill created that plan to turn Charlottesville into more of a green city. The Community Design Center of Rochester has asked Lee Quill to come offer his ideas for re-greening the living city. He'll make that presentation tomorrow night at the Gleason Works Auditorium, but first, Lee is with us on Connections. This may be one of the few cities where you could pull this off, Lee. Your plane landed when?
11:35.
Well, welcome to Rochester, and it's great to have you here. Thanks for taking the time to join us here.
Thank you, Evan.
And Johnny Monroe is here, the Executive Director of the Regional Design Center of Rochester, and this is a series that brings in people from around the country to offer their ideas. We'd love to hear from our listeners, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Johnny, how did you hook up with Lee? How'd you find him?
Well, Lee and I have known each other both personally and professionally for some time. I actually went to architecture school with his wife and met him some years ago when we were in New Haven, Connecticut. And I've watched Lee and his career path sort of in a way go concurrently with interests that we have at the Design Center about how to restructure our communities in a more thoughtful and sensitive way.
Lee, what's going on right now when it comes to design? I feel like Rochester, as I said, Charlottesville, Rochester, I mean, that's hardly outliers in looking for ways to kind of re-green. But what happened, was it 30, 40 years ago? Did we become sort of addicted to have this fealty to grid automobiles? And did we forget about pedestrian space, green space? Was there an architectural era that we are coming to regret?
I don't think that we're coming to an era where we regret, but you all have a very big history here with Olmsted, which you can build upon. Mm-hmm. Many cities don't have that legacy. However, most cities do have a legacy of open space, but has been disjointed or unconnected through disinvestment in the cities over many, many years. There's a resurgence in urban living today. And what we're doing is kind of rediscovering our cities. Many times the new open space that we find will actually come about where it was not an obvious or existing space, but maybe more of a found space.
And when it comes to looking at Rochester, for example, you're not here to diagnose all the problems and fix them all. You're here to offer your own experience from other places. But is it wise to look at cities of similar sizes? Or are there lessons for Rochester in a smaller city like Charlottesville, a larger city? I mean, the former mayor of Boston, Tom Menino, who passed away last year, was part of this speaking series as well. Now, Rochester is not Boston, is not Charlottesville, but are there lessons to learn looking around?
Despite the fact that Charlottesville is about the quarter the size, both land area as well as population of Rochester, there are lessons to be learned because of similarities between all urban environments. Today, we're dealing with the same issues that have been common of disinvestment, poverty, concentration of public housing in blocks, which are, were taken apart a little bit with the HOPE 6 project, but now it's moved on to other programs. So yes, the same problems and same issues and same opportunities that you would find in a smaller city are same that you can find here in Rochester.
All right. What I want to do is make sure our listeners know they can join the conversation. I already see the phone ringing, which, Lee, I mean, again, you're just got to Rochester. Typically, our listeners kind of wait a bit. They let things sink in. They join the program a little bit more in the second half hour. But I see the phone already ringing. And so I've got plenty to talk about with Lee Quill, the founding principal of Cunningham Quill Architects in Washington, D.C., and Johnny Monroe from the Regional Design Center of Rochester. Lee is speaking tomorrow night at Gleason Works Auditorium, 7 p.m., and you can still attend. Information
Absolutely.
On that?
Yes. You can go to our website, Find out all of the key information, including the location of the Gleason Works Auditorium, which is right on University Avenue. It's on a bus line. There's plenty of parking, and we look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow night.
And if they want to get tickets, they can go there. What's the website?
It's www.rrcdc.org.
Okay, and the subject tomorrow night is Regreening the Living City. So this is not the host show. This is a community show. So Ryan in Geneva, you're first. Go ahead, Ryan.
Good morning, Evan. Thank you for having me. We're re-examining the comprehensive plan for the town of Geneva and city of Geneva, and we're really concerned about greenscape and walkability and mixed-use development to decrease our dependency on vehicles. But one of the main concerns I have is revisiting a space or a city or a town and spurring economic development, because without that economic development, you know, it kind of stays on the drawing board. And I was wondering if your guests could give us some ideas and some thoughts on how changing the plan and making a city greener can spur economic development.
Yeah, Ryan, why don't you hang in there? Stay on the line, and we'll let Lee go ahead and answer that first. Go ahead, Lee.
Sure. What happens with regreening a city, or at least I can speak to Charlottesville and even use another example in New York, another ecological corridor or greenway was actually the High Line in New York, a little bit different than what we were dealing with in Charlottesville. But in Manhattan, you can see the examples of how rediscovering this space, bringing people together, connecting neighborhoods and places along a route that had been abandoned for many, many years in New York City, also created an attraction for people to come to a part of the forgotten area of a city, such as New York, and it spurred quite a bit of development. Some of this development was going to come, but it also helped concentrate it around actually the High Line in New York. In Charlottesville, we're doing the same thing, where we're actually taking areas of public housing and Section 8 assisted housing and former industrial land and repositioning that into a mixed income, mixed use neighborhood, allowing for a mix of uses that they have not had with the former industrial context. And there's quite a bit of interest in development, because they had never seen or viewed this area of the city in the way that we're positioning it right now.
Ryan, you want to follow up there?
Well, I that's encouraging, because one of the things that I moved my company to Geneva from Florida, and one of the reasons was the natural resources here, the lakes, both Lake Ontario and the Finger Lakes, and I felt that it wasn't economic reasons necessarily I brought the company here, but the livability for myself and my family. And so, but you know, you do these things and you wonder if it's just you or if other people are motivated in the same fashion.
Well, thanks for the call, Ryan. And I'm trying to, as fast as I can, look up what Geneva. Ryan, do you know what Geneva's population is offhand?
It's 13,000 for the city, and it's just over 3,000 in the towns, the gray areas.
Only 13. I would have guessed it a little bit larger, but interesting.
It's one of those cities that was at 20 at its peak in the 60s, and everyone walked to work, and there were trolleys, and there was a lot of good, you know, businesses within walkable distance, and now we've moved to suburban areas, and everyone drives their car.
Well, Ryan, before you go, let me ask you one question, then I'll kind of kick it to Lee and Johnny as well. But that's the question of whether more green space is viewed as kind of a zero-sum game, as in more green physical space, less opportunity for business development, or is that sort of a false choice? Ryan, you obviously have an interest in seeing things a certain way. How do you view that from a business perspective?
Well, from a business perspective, we're a solar energy developer, and we are always in this battle between usable space for solar arrays and making sure we don't inhibit, take up a residential property or commercial property. What we see is we just see a lot of wasted space across the board. A planner that we're working with down here made the example of, a Wegmans parking lot that Wegmans need, you know, that big parking lot is a popular business, but if you're walking there, you have to walk across this big parking lot to get to your goal. Whereas if pedestrians were, you know, thought about it in the design, you could probably use the same space more effectively so that you weren't cutting it off to pedestrians and bicycle traffic.
Well, Ryan, thanks for the call, and you know, interesting things to think about there. He's talking about a big box store with a big parking lot. I already have a couple of questions and comments online. Every time Johnny's in here, people want to talk about very specific projects, which is fine. Johnny and Roger are always willing to tackle those when they come in here. But let me frame that question again to Lee more generally. When you talk to a business like a municipality like a Charlottesville, or if Rochester called and said, "Hey, Cunningham Quill, we want more green space, but we're concerned that it's a zero-sum game, that if we re-inject green space, that it is definitionally going to remove opportunity for development." Yes or no?
No. What it is it becomes, most of the time, such as in Charlottesville, the green space was before an open parking lot, a vacant field, former industrial site, and a destroyed, ravaged creek bed. What we were able to do was reposition and relook at this particular area and create green space from a space that had a little bit of it before, but not a system, an open pace system or green way as we created. And what this does is it actually has created a catalyst for development, because now we have a park setting that buildings can front on, that pedestrian paths and walkways can occur, so they get people out of their neighborhoods and start to connect neighborhoods together, adjacent neighborhoods that hadn't been connected before. And it becomes really more of a draw, an interconnector, in bringing people together. So what it does is actually starts to become a catalyst if it's handled the right way.
We're talking to Lee Quill, who's a founding principal of Cunningham Quill Architects in Washington, D.C., and Johnny Monroe, the executive director of the Regional Design Center of Rochester. Lee is in town to give a presentation tomorrow night, and it is part of the Reshaping Rochester series. Lee will speak tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Gleason Works Auditorium on regreening the living city. That's our subject of discussion this hour, but if you want to weigh in with specific questions or general ones for Lee or Johnny, you could do that. It's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Melissa on Twitter is probably like many people in that every time Johnny's in, someone wants to ask about Costco project. They heard the mention of the Wegmans parking lot that Ryan was talking about in Geneva, and they're hearing about Costco in Rochester. Every time you're here, people want to ask about whether the designers are happy with the plans that you're seeing. So I will get that out of the way now, since Melissa's one of several asking about it. Johnny, Costco's coming to Rochester. Are you okay with what you're seeing?
Well, I think whenever we get a big project like this, there's an opportunity, to do it in particular ways. And I think, as Roger and I had explained the last time we were on, initially we saw a more typical new urbanist approach to the land there. And, these projects morph and they change. And I think that, people are excited about Costco coming in. I think we always have to look at the possibilities of how we take a national model and create local standards that cause the national model to morph, to adapt to what our area is like. When we start to change the form of our land, which is a glacially formed area, and we start to flatten it and move things in a way that are not taking full advantage of what we have, when we adopt national models that we know can change and vary depending on the location. All you have to do is drive to various parts of the country and see national models like Rite Aid stores and others that take on the look and character of the place that they're in more authentically. And I think that when our area feels more confident about demanding that we'll get we'll get a design in final projects that we can all stand up and really applaud. And so I think that the area welcomes Costco. and the development of Costco, but we need to think about how we're accepting development.
So that's a long way of saying welcome Costco, but maybe you'd have done things a little differently.
Well, I think that I'm not the developer.
I know you're not.
So I will gracefully bow out on that.
Okay.
One.
All right. Well, that's a fair point. But let me ask Lee then. I can't remember when my wife and I were in Healdsburg, California, for example. I can't remember if there were no fast food joints there or if they just were blended into the architecture by a local policy to the point where they're almost unnoticeable. They don't stick out. They're not plasticky, et cetera. And that, for some reason, years ago, sparked this idea in my mind that, you know, that you can set the rules locally for, it doesn't mean that you don't allow a big box or a fast food. Sometimes I think there's a question on what's appropriate, what fits where. But Lee, speaking more generally and more broadly, when it comes to big box, for example, it seems to require, as Ryan said, the notion of a big parking lot. It's just sort of what it comes with the territory, it seems. But does it, or are there ways to blend it in, to work it into a more of a pedestrian mode?
Oh, it's very interesting because for years, the large retailers, big box retailers, were very reticent to adopt their suburban model of the large parking lot and a single pod store to an urban setting. But in Washington, we've actually seen, and in other parts of the country, we've seen this model. In Washington, D.C., Walmart desperately wanted to come into the city and has adopted a new urban model where it brings the building up to the street. The parking is either underneath or under enclosed behind activated space along the street. A couple of years ago, when I was in Denver, just southwest of Denver, there is a in Belmar, which is a new development that has gotten quite a bit of notoriety for kind of reinventing the suburbs. There's a Target there located in that development, which again engages the street and is designed as an urban model. Parking is underneath and is screened, but again, it's an urban model. So there are urban models, as Johnny is alluding to, that can come in. And part of it is having just making sure that you're not trying to say don't come, but what you are saying, when you come, we need you to fit a little bit differently, more pedestrian, more walkable, and more focused on an urban, contributing to the urban setting. So by doing that and taking that as a series of kind of guides that will help shape that, most of these retailers, if the city is behind it, will comply.
I was going to ask, do big boxes resist that?
At first they do, but the marketplace knows, by the time they've decided they want to come to a location, they've discovered a need, or at least somewhat of a need that they believe is there. So they're pretty interested in coming, and of course they want to do the least most of the time that they have to from an economic perspective. But most of the urban models that we're seeing around the country right now are not taking them to places where they really couldn't go economically, or they wouldn't be done.
You used the phrase reinventing the suburbs, and in my own mind, I have a feeling on what that means, but I'd love to hear it from an architect's perspective.
Well, there's a specialist, Ellen Dunham Jones, yes, and June Williamson, who have written a book on this, and they were actually part of the series a couple of years ago with Johnny. And their premise on reinventing the suburbs is taking underutilized or vacant malls or strip centers and re-envisioning them, repositioning them as contributing urban environments. Belmar is this one I talked about outside of Denver, where they literally came in and took down a shopping mall and created a new town center. And when we say the word town center, that's probably one of the most misused words. A lot of times you'll still find developments through in suburban context calling themselves a town center, which is basically a strip center with a large parking lot that happens to be in the middle of a housing development. What we're talking about from a town center or a village center is actually a walkable center where it has open space, it has walkability, parking is either tucked in behind the stores or in structures, and you can get out and experience just like small town or downtown is today.
And you also mentioned a few of the examples that you look around and you think that someone is doing things in a really innovative or effective way. If you had the mayor of Rochester's ear and she said, Lee, who's really doing it well? Give me an example, point one right now that, besides Charlottesville.
They are doing it well.
Lee's on the program for a reason. He's obviously in demand and has a track record. But who else is doing it well?
I think you can go to a number of cities around the country and see how they're doing it well. And in fact, you're doing some things well here too. But, you know, there's always room to look at new ways of doing things in no matter what city you are. I come from the city of Washington, D.C. There are a number of things that have been initiated there of redeveloping neighborhoods that years ago one would not even go into. And it's really about creating place, of creating a synergy of mixed use that we've talked about, of walkability, of having the components of open space within a 5-minute walk. It includes biking, alternative methods. You know, if you don't have a metro like we do in Washington, but you have a good bus system, you can still set up transportation systems for biking, and you mentioned the parking here, convenient parking, but not dominant. Just take away the car as a dominant mode and allow for all these different modes to occur and going to a mixed environment, and you can really turn a neighborhood around.
Let me get to the phones. We've got a couple callers on some of these similar veins here. So let me hit Elliot in Rochester. Go ahead, Elliot.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just was wondering, there's been talk for a couple of years about an urban skate park somewhere in downtown Rochester. They've floated ideas for different sites. And I was just wondering if the panel could kind of chime in on their thoughts on urban skate parks, pluses, minuses, if they've run into them a lot, if they think that would be a good idea. That's about it.
Elliot, before I let you go, I suspect you're calling with some feelings about your desire to see one here.
Yeah, definitely. I think there are some real cultural aspects to it that would really flourish. There's a pretty solid skate scene in Rochester, and it would really be great to see a manifestation, like an architectural manifestation of that.
That's a good question, Lee.
Skate park can fit in many, many ways. In Denver, not to use them always, but there's a number of things. In Denver, in the Lodo, lower downtown neighborhood, near the light rail station, they have integrated along the South Platte River a skate park. But it is within a park system, an open space network of biking and walking that you can stroll to this place, but it's not too far from residential units, both rental and single family. So it can work very well. The key is to make sure that this is a place that can become multi-generational. Yeah. It's quite interesting to watch the kids out on, or young adults, out on their skateboards maneuvering through the hills and the valleys of a skate park. It's a, kind of a dance that occurs with this for the really good ones. So the key is to make sure that there are places for seating and viewing this from different perspectives so that it becomes a place that older generations can walk and sit with their kids or their grandkids. Others can just hang out. And it becomes a place of gathering as opposed to an outpost on the edge.
Yeah, and Elliot, based on Lee's comments there, and forgive me for not being totally up to speed on this. I think we talked on this program last year about where some ideas, but do we know in Rochester where you'd like to be?
Where I'd like to see it? Or
yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and where things are moving in terms of a skate park.
You know, I haven't heard a lot about it. I think the last site that I had saw was along the river, kind of parallel to Mount Hope. Like, there was some open space by some of that new development right along the river, and that would be nice. I'm not real sure how downtown it could be. I mean, you would need a decent chunk of open space. But, yeah, I'm not sure where it is. I heard a lot about fundraising and not sure where it stands currently. So I could myself do a little more digging on that.
Well, look, now you have a connections assignment. You can email me when you find the latest, and maybe we'll come back and we'll focus on a separate day if you're so inclined.
I think,
yeah, that works.
I think that Lee makes a very good point about the multi-generational nature of public space. After World War II in this country, we kind of lost a lot of the spirit in our public realm. And one of the things that really hits you when you travel to other countries is how central the public realm is to everyday life. And offering choices both for generational use and a variety of recreational or passive use, and also the issue of transportation is really key. Rochester doesn't have a lot of choices in terms of transportation modes. And therefore, a developer looking to redevelop sections of the city or the outlying areas has to consider the car, because the car is just the default item. And so we're actually in a very interesting time, because the nation is poised to relook at their transportation systems. I think over the next 25 years, we're going to see real physical changes in our cities, particularly our mid-sized American cities like Rochester, because of that.
All right, I've got to get to a break. If you are on the phone, and the phones have lit up with interest in a number of different subjects, June, Lee, Bonnie, we're coming to you next, and we're going to talk as well about some of the questions we're seeing on Twitter about what multimodal means. We're going to talk about other kinds of green space. So a lot going on here as we talk about regreening the living city with Lee Quill, founding principal of Cunningham Quill Architects in Washington, D.C., and Johnny Monroe, the executive director of the Regional Design Center of Rochester. Lee is in town. He says he just flew in, and boy, are his arms tired. That's the only time I will ever use that, I promise. But he just landed, came straight to Connections, and tomorrow night he's giving a presentation at 7 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium as part of the Reshaping Rochester series. You can get tickets, Johnny, where?
www.rrcdc.org.
Okay, tickets available now. But the conversation continues in 60 seconds with your phone calls on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Norma Holland, Andrea Holland, Freda Schneider, Allison Roberts, Dresden Engel. Those five women make up Estrofest, a female comedy troupe who took a couple of years off, but they are back next month, and they are in studio with us next hour. We're going to laugh a little, talk a little bit about truth in comedy, and what makes funny funny to the women of Estrofest.
Victims of human trafficking are often forced into prostitution, and that can force them to live with a criminal record. But in many states, there's a law that can help wipe the slate clean.
I'm not ever going to forget what I've done and what I've gone through, but at the same time, I don't want it thrown in my face every time I'm trying to seek employment.
Justice for trafficking victims, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Just about every phone line lit up now as we talk about regreening the living city. Let me get back to the phones. And June in Greece. Go ahead, June.
Yes. Good afternoon. I'm with the local chapter of National Audubon Society, and we want to commend you for in the city for greening the city. And we want to suggest that you use native trees and plants,
yes,
in greening the city for a number of reasons. One, that they will supply food for native animals and insects. But there are a number of advantages as well, because they tend to require less care and less water.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And Johnny was immediately nodding. Lee, what do you think?
I would agree. With us on this project was a wonderful landscape architecture firm called Oculus out of Washington, D.C. in Charlottesville, colleagues we've known for a number of years. And this was actually part of the discussion that came up. Part of our work in the ecological corridor we created as part of the strategic investment area plan for Charlottesville included restoration of a creek, Pollux Branch. And there was a lot of discussion about how to work with restoring this particular watershed, not only through its dual system in the upper areas, but also in the restoring it. So definitely the native plants were issues that we discussed, as well as providing connectivity down to a regional path system and waterway that will allow for animals and biodiversity to move its way into the center of the city.
And Johnny, you are nodding immediately at June's point.
Oh, I agree. I think that we need to regreen in a way that does honor our local species in every way. That just makes a lot of sense.
Back to the phones, and this is Lee in Rochester. Go ahead, Lee.
Hello. Listen, back in the 1990s, there was this plan called Vision 2000.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody there is aware of it.
Johnny's already nodding again.
They had a lot of ideas about... I'm sorry?
Oh, no. I think our executive director of the Regional Design Center, you're familiar, Johnny?
Absolutely.
Okay, go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, they had a lot of the same ideas I'm hearing now. So I just wanted to know, how free is Mr. Quill going to be to, like, you know, to change those plans or to insert himself?
All right, well, hold on one second here, Lee. Stay there because the host has to clarify. Lee's here in town because tomorrow night he's giving a presentation as part of the Reshaping Rochester series, offering his perspective on work in different municipalities around the country. His firm based in Washington, D.C. But Lee, are you doing any work in Rochester right now?
Not right now.
Okay. do you want to break any news on this?
But it's a fantastic city. We love it here.
Okay.
But I will say for Lee's comments with changing, if the plan, and Johnny can speak to the plan, but the key is if you have a good plan and it's something worth pursuing, you can stick with it. And it may take some time to come to fruition. It takes both citizens as well as political leadership to move a plan forward. And I can speak to Charlottesville, which is we had a tremendous amount of political leadership, both from the city council and a city councilwoman by the name of Kathy Galvin, who was her baby, the plan, as well as the planning department, the economic development department staff. It was tremendous on that level, as well as the citizens. So we're very enthused about this moving forward, and they're actually looking forward to this. Was only adopted last March, and they're already moving forward with implementation in the first stages.
Lee, you want to follow up there?
Well, so yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, the citizens groups have been trying to have input on the Vision 2000 plan. We haven't met with much success. You know, the city hasn't really been affable so far. So I'm gonna go down the road and hear what this guy say, and you know, hopefully we'll all get a vision that we can all live with.
Great point and great calls. Johnny, you want to add anything there?
I absolutely support what you're saying. I think that the citizens in this community have spent lots of time and effort over the years expressing their ideas. And I think that translating that into a physical plan that the entire community can get behind and have ownership of, that transcends various, you know, administrations and has both long-term and short-term goals that everybody can realize together is just critical.
Well, I think Lee, the caller, makes an important point here when it comes to timeline. And, you know, sometimes things move slowly. You know, I think of when I talk to people who are in ad agencies and they have clients and their clients will say, I need you to make something that will go viral for me. I mean, you don't always have a magic formula to go viral. I have this vision of Cunningham Quill coming in and municipal leaders saying, we're going to need you to solve everything in 6 to 12 months. You know, there has to be, and I understand timelines can be tight, especially when there are maybe term limits, but there has to be, to some degree, a willingness to wait or to be patient, at least, Lee. And are political leaders patient enough when it comes to sort of regreening and design projects?
I think most political leaders understand it is going to take some time. They would like to see some. The idea is a couple things. Number one is you need a good plan, a pathway to move forward. That has been, has received wide community support as well as business support. In the SIA plan, Strategic Investment Area plan, we were on the ground for a little over a year. But in that less than about 9 to 10 month period, we conducted over 40 community and citizen engagement meetings, from stakeholder meetings to community workshops and charrettes to town hall meetings to one-on-ones. And getting the support of the community was key. Once that moved forward, there was a momentum that allowed us to move forward after the plan was adopted. But giving a clarity of where you want to go, what you want to do, and then having stages of it. We also broke it out into a series of task and implementation tasks that clearly align near-term, short-term, and long-term, and who may be responsible for helping to move that forward from what agency or jurisdictional component. That way, there is a roadmap that you can follow, and that helps elected officials tremendously.
But there are certain things that can be done in relatively short order once decisions are made, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, especially when it comes to regreening, I think that is some comfort to people who are very interested to see change. And so let me get back to the phones. Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes. Hi. A couple things. One is just quick and passing here. We can look out the windows and see how bad the weather has been. And anything to do with walkability, the city's going to have to deal with,
yes.
Assuming the weather's not going to get better in the next few years. With sidewalks not being cleaned, and nobody can walk on these sidewalks. So that's something I just wanted to state. But the bigger or the equally important point here is that, and the previous caller kind of touched on this, is that really what is really, really, I think, needed is a strong, strong outreach by the city that is heavily supported by going into these neighborhoods. And I'm especially thinking of the poorer neighborhoods, because what people need is they need to have not only that strong voice, but the way you get a strong voice is to become more informed, to become knowledgeable about these issues. And people are here and there knowledgeable, but they're not knowledgeable and informed as you might want them to be. So it's very hard for people to visualize something that they have not been involved in very much. And I can think where I live in the Northeast, which is one of the poor areas, when they put in some new housing along in one of the areas that had been previously Kodak parking lot a few years ago, and it's right near the small recreation center, which is on an adjacent a corner. And there's a huge space open in between those areas because it's on a 90-degree angle. And instead of opening up that space and having it be more community friendly and using those two things together to kind of not just be separated out, they didn't do that. So now we have a strip of houses, newer houses, and then this older small recreation center at the other end of the 90-degree turn, instead of having the open space. So that's just one example of not involving people enough. And a lot of people, I have this idea, I have that idea, and they often need to come together to, first of all, have people who have a little bit more knowledge talk to them, and also to build that strength in these communities that's lasting. It's just not hit and miss. And a quick other point is that I had called the city recently about the green plan, wondering about it myself, and no one there seemed to know anything about it. The person who was in charge, I think, has left maybe 2 or 3 years ago. So that status is a little hazy.
All right. Bonnie, thanks for the call. Lots to chew on there. Lee, go ahead.
Well, a couple things. One thing I would say is one of the most rewarding aspects of the plan that we did in Charlottesville was engaging communities of need that normally are not part of the process, the planning process. We did this in a number of ways. One was stakeholder meetings in the initial of having members of public housing and Section 8 housing and those in need of jobs, et cetera. We had special meetings with them to hear exactly what their desires and hopes were with regards to the plan and for open space needs in the city. We then also had larger forums, as I mentioned, but we also then had some of those meetings at their residences. We went to the public housing residents to their facilities and actually had meetings, workshops with them and the neighbors around there. What was wonderful about what came out of this was that we put people together from different neighborhoods and different groups that had traditionally never really sat together, and we got them together, sitting together, talking and discussing things, and they found they had much more in common than they thought they had. They aired some misconceptions about why people would come to certain neighborhoods and why they wouldn't. And by the end, we really had a much different approach to the plan than we thought we would originally when we went in with the original request for proposal. But what came out of that was really a transformation of the process of people talking to each other. So the idea here of when you're working in spaces with different neighborhoods, such as the poorer areas or not. It's really about engaging the community very extensively and intensely to find out what their needs are to help shape what the project will and the effort will really be.
Johnny, when it comes to downtown or Rochester development, for example, there is always some segment that we hear from either on this program or when I read comments elsewhere that is cynical about the nature of housing, mixed housing, et cetera, that doesn't believe that there's sort of a coexistence that's possible. And then the other side of that are the people who worry about the fact that we have a rather segregated city still.
We do.
And I think Lee is talking about actually bringing in and listening
yes.
to people and making them stakeholders early on, as opposed to either leaving them out of the process entirely
mm-hmm.
or you know, sort of ostensibly including them but not really listening. I don't know, in terms of Rochester, and we're not talking about any specific project to Rochester, but can this get better here? I mean, do you see that as an issue here?
Well, it's a very compelling issue, and it really has a lot to do with social forces that have been at work for some time in this country that have created a country of isolated communities that don't integrate on a number of different levels in ways that we used to. When you think about traditional neighborhoods that we all grew up in as kids, at least in my generation and prior to that, we had so many different strata of society within blocks of each other. And so we knew people who were millionaires and we knew people who were on welfare. We didn't necessarily, so easily point a finger at somebody to say that they're different. We welcomed
or feared
differences. We worked together both from a neighborhood perspective and a community perspective. We were more densely configured. And I'm not talking about crowded, but dense, so that we, had a lot more access to things through walking and public transportation than we do now. So now here we are. We have a society that has all of these isolated communities, and we know that we, from a sustainability standpoint and from a resource standpoint, need to do things to thoughtfully sort of reinvest in different ways in redesigning neighborhoods to work as they worked for eons before that and have for many years in other cultures that are older than ours. And that is neighborhoods that have and communities that have a variety of different people living, relatatively closely to one another that coexist rather nicely. And so the only fear we have is based on sort of a preconceived notion about why that won't work. And when we know that it does work. And I think that that's kind of the direction that things are going in now, and I'm very, very encouraged by that.
Mark writes to the program an email about what multimodal means. He says that Mark says, I admit that I would like to see us give up our addiction to the automobile, and sometimes I think re-greening means high-speed rail. I'm not so foolish as to believe it's going to happen anytime soon, but I'm wondering if your guest can share whether other municipalities are looking more seriously at rail projects. That's an interesting question. Lee?
A lot of communities are looking at rail or bus rapid transit.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be really looking at both. The days of big dollars coming from the federal government or from state government are limited, if not gone. So we have to, with the limited resources we have today, we have to look at how connectivity will happen on multiple mm-hmm. levels. So when we talk about multimodal, it deals with walking, it deals with biking, it deals with the idea of buses. It can be bus rapid transit, can have a dedicated right-of-way just like a light rail would do. Half the cost or less, I should say a lot less, maybe not half, but less than the cost than fixed rail and can then be converted later on. And high-speed rail is really for longer distances. Mm-hmm. But if you want to look at how successful that is, obviously Canada has connections between Quebec and Montreal, which is a high-speed rail, if I recall. And I know England has quite a few, and we have Accela on the East Coast from Boston down through New York down to Washington. So for traveling long distances, the idea of high-speed rail is tremendous. But for the shorter distances, in a more urban scale, of transportation. We need to be looking at the walking, the biking, the bus rapid. And, of course, we have to accommodate the car. But the car should be put back into the condition it was, like Johnny was talking about, in traditional neighborhoods, where it was an element but not the dominant element.
Mm-hmm. Is there a sense that in the future, if it's not going to be a European kind of high-speed rail, and again, in Europe, high-speed rail really does it connect, as Lee says, cities to cities, but not necessarily cities to rural or well, I mean, I guess at times. But the bottom line is this. If we're not likely to see a new large-scale high-speed rail system in the Northeast, in this country, is the future of multimodal more likely to say, yes, automobile, but we've got to get a little bit more used to or aim our design to get us to drive somewhere, park that car, and then leave it for most of the day to spend more time, okay, you drive and park, but I'm going to walk until I'm going to head home at night as opposed to drive another mile here, drive a quarter mile here, et cetera, et cetera. Is that part of the recipe?
That is part of the recipe, is a drive, and then this is what these new urban centers are about. You will drive there, and then you get out and walk. But in kind of the rework of our cities, the idea of walking and biking is really critical to mobility. This multimodal component is very important to getting one out of their car, as well as out of the bus, even if they could, to walk and discover their neighborhood. That's where the distributed system of open space, or these greenways, or the multimodal, or the ecological corridor that we created, was right in the center of the city, former industrial area. So it starts to bring the neighborhoods together, and you can actually walk within 5 minutes.
Well, I've got a few minutes left. He's talking about a project in Charlottesville, Virginia. That's what. Tell us what it looks like. The ecological center, that corridor, what's it look like there?
The ecological corridor is in the center of the town. It's south of the downtown mall. It's a pedestrian mall, which is one of the few left in the country. And it's in an old stream bed that used to be an industrial area of silk warehouses and milling and ice houses, etc. We did our historic research on the area and found out there was actually an underground creek that ran through this area. So what we ended up doing was, through investigation further and studying of watershed runoff, et cetera, found an opportunity to do a dual system in the upper areas of this. What that means is the water that was in a culvert below and is in a culvert is still going to be brought from the higher elevations from downtown, but we're collecting the water from the surrounding areas in a series of different conditions, of basins, of meadows, of play fields, urban farming, and then ultimately water gardens that are part of a plaza, and then they join through a series of weirs of cleansing and then into a restored creek bed and creek stream corridor here. So what's interesting is we were able to take existing conditions, do some research, and then create a new ecological condition that allows it to be both a park as well as a cleansing area for dealing with stormwater.
How long is that corridor?
It's about a mile long.
About a mile long. Can we see pictures online?
If you go to our website of cunninghamquill.com, and if you come tomorrow night, you'll see a lot about it.
Yeah.
But look for the strategic investment area plan. There are a lot of imagery. We did a number of collages to help illustrate the kind of environments that we're seeking.
And we have an exhibit at the Design Center, actually, in the gallery, of boards, beautifully illustrated boards that show this project. So we encourage people to come to the Design Center gallery and check it out there and on our website.
How's that going over?
The plan?
Yeah, the plan, the corridor.
It's going very well. The city is very engaged. This has been recognized both from the state of Maryland, state of Virginia, state of D.C., both in American Planning as well as AIA awards already since its adoption. So there's a lot of interest in how we're approaching problems that are traditionally not just small cities, but large cities.
I think you're seeing a glimpse of what Lee's going to talk about tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Gleason Works Auditorium. And tickets still available. Where is Gleason, by the way?
It's on University Avenue, right near Culver Road, actually, and there's plenty of parking right next to the building.
I don't know if Lee would have designed it that way, but there is plenty of parking there. You'll have to tell us.
Well, that parking that's next to the building is relatively new. There used to be a lawn there.
Yeah.
And there was some pressure.
No, I joke because we did a show last week on parking in Rochester, and every single phone line was lit up for the entire hour. Mm-hmm. It was remarkable how people get fired up about parking issues.
It's an emotional issue.
Well, but you know what? What we found out again this hour, and we always find that out whenever Johnny is here or Roger Brown, the folks from the Regional Design Center, no shortage of interest in this issue. And that's why they have their Reshaping Rochester series. So tomorrow night, Lee Quill's going to be there for Regreening the Living City at 7 p.m. You can go to their website, which is a good place to get tickets. And Johnny, one more time, the website is?
rrcdc.org.
Lee, you made it on time, and I'm grateful. I know it was a tight schedule, great interest in this, so thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Evan.
Lee Quill, founding partner of Cunningham Quill Architects in Washington, D.C. Short break, and the Women of Estrofest next hour. Stay with us.